Check out my new book, Coping Courageously, a heart-centered guide for navigating a loved one's illness without losing yourself. It's appropriate for you as a clinician, for your patients, and for anyone you know who has a seriously ill loved one or an aging parent. Check it out and tell a friend. Welcome to the Integrative Palliative Podcast, where we help physicians and other clinicians master the art of integrative symptom management so they can wholeheartedly care for themselves as they expertly care for their patients. Welcome to the Integrative Palliative Podcast. I'm Dr. Delia Caramonte, and I could not be more excited about our guest this week. We have a truly distinguished person with us today. With us today to talk about the end-of-life experience and particularly dignity at the end of life, we have Dr. Harvey Max Chochenov, who is a distinguished professor of psychiatry at the University of Manitoba and a senior scientist at Cancer Care Manitoba Research Institute. His more than 300 career publications have broached very diverse topics, including depression, quality of life, suicide, vulnerability, spirituality, and existential distress towards the end of life. He has also led a large program of research targeting issues related to dignity within the healthcare setting, which includes the development and study of dignity therapy, which we will certainly talk about today. Dr. Chochenov is the co-founder of the Canadian Virtual Hospice and co-editor of the Handbook of Psychiatry and Palliative Medicine. His latest book is called Dignity in Care, The Human Side of Medicine. He's been the recipient of numerous awards and honors, including the Canadian Medical Association's highest recognition, the FNG Star Award. And in 2020, he was inducted into the Canadian Medical Hall of Fame. Welcome, Dr. Chochenov.
Thanks so much. I'm happy to be here.
Talk to us a little bit about dignity at the end of life, and what does that even mean?
Well, it's actually that very question that began us thinking about pursuing some empirical work in this area. Just to kind of back up about 30 or so years, we have been studying various issues in end-of-life care, looking at things like depression, desire for death, will to live, and our attention then turned to what was happening in the Benelux countries where euthanasia and assisted suicide had been lawfully practiced. And we were curious to know what was it about end-of-life experience that led people to feeling they no longer wanted to be here. And well, we could talk about that in a hypothetical way. In the Benelux countries, I mean, there was an opportunity to actually understand circumstances where the person no longer wanted to be here. So we read the literature, discovered some really interesting, influential articles, as it turned out in terms of my research career, where investigators had looked at the prevalence of what they called MDEL, or medical decisions to end life, and then drilled down even further to find out why, according to the Dutch physicians who had now helped these patients in their lives, why they had sought that pathway. And that's where the dignity clue first came onto our radar, because the findings, and this was a study that was published in The Lancet by first author Paul Vandermass, the findings indicated that loss of dignity, more so than any other variable that they discerned from these physicians, was the reasons why they sought out a hastened death and had in fact received euthanasia or assisted suicide. At the time when we looked at the literature, there were no empirical studies on dignity in terminal illness. So that was really our entry point. And we began studying dignity towards the end of life. We did a series of different studies, qualitative studies, quantitative studies, and we discovered that it is it's complex, it's textured and layered. Getting back to your question, I mean, what exactly does it mean? It means a multitude of things depending on who the patient is. I guess if you look at our qualitative studies that looked at and created a model of dignity in the terminally ill, it said that there, you know, depending on who you are, there are a multitude of variables that can affect your sense of dignity. There are physical variables, You know, so the physical experience of being ill. There are psychosocial variables. So the way in which you experience, you know, your environment being reactive or inattentive to your needs. And then there's the internal environment, which has to do with kind of your psychological and spiritual makeup. And depending again on your wiring, variables within those categories are going to have a more or lesser influence on your sense of dignity.
Can I ask you one question before we go further? In the research that was initially done, that where dignity rose to the top is something of interest, was it defined for people? Or did it just say, is it something about your dignity? And they answered, but we don't really know what they meant.
Well, again, you put your finger on exactly why we embarked on this, because the data that was coming out of Holland at the time was really secondhand data from physicians who were reporting on the experience of their now deceased patients.
I see.
And they weren't provided, you know, some a priori definition for dignity. So you've got the situation where, according to these physicians who had assisted the death of their patient, loss of dignity seemed to be a real player. But we didn't know...
whatever that is.
We didn't know how they defined that. And the source of information was at least one step removed. I mean, if you're going to study dignity in the terminally ill, you want to study people who are approaching death,
right,
which is why we conducted studies. And over the decades have always had studies where, I mean, our primary informants are the people who are undergoing the experience. People, you know, who are registered with our palliative care program, usually less than 6 months to live, vast majority end stage malignancy, and on average, somewhere in late 60s, early 70s. That's sort of the demographic of patients that we have recruited to most of our studies.
And is there an official definition that you give to people? Because as I think about this word, which I thought I understood until I started thinking about it more, thinking about you, and I realized I really don't understand it. You know, I have a sense of what it means, but if you ask me to define it, I don't think I could.
Yeah, and I think the important piece here is that it's not something meant for us to define for others, but for them to define for us. So when I am asking a patient about, you know, their end of life experience, or if I'm, and if the issue of dignity is part of that discussion, I want to understand what is their experience. You know, how do they define that? What shapes it for them? And the interesting finding, and for me, this was really kind of a moment of epiphany, when we did the quantitative studies on dignity. In other words, we asked people to say, okay, which of these variables, including things like pain and anxiety, depression, family support, which of these variables influence your sense of dignity? Hmm. The thing that came out as most predictive was this notion of appearance, or how they experience themselves to be seen or perceived by others.
Oh, that's fascinating. I wouldn't have gone there. I'm surprised. That's very interesting.
Well, maybe if I say a little bit more about it, it'll sound more kind of spot on, because what it really meant was, and this, I mean, we published our findings in The Lancet, and then had a separate article in the Journal of Clinical Oncology, which I called Dignity in the Eye of the Beholder. And what I try and explain there, at least metaphorically, and this is based on our data, patients are looking towards healthcare providers for a reflection in their eye that will be affirming of their sense of dignity.
Okay, that makes sense to me.
In other words,
a sense of self, right? Like, see me as I see myself in my real sense of self.
Exactly. And I want to see, you know, kind of my personhood, you know, reflected back in your gaze. If all I see
is
a problem checklist or a differential diagnosis, I feel that, you know, as I've written, you know, that patienthood has eclipsed personhood.
Right. You don't see the fullness of me if you see me as an old sick person.
Exactly. Or the proverbial, you know, lung tumor in bed three. And none of us, it's ironic, because we spend the entirety of our lives learning how to look after patients. And what you find out is that nobody wants to seen in a generic way as just a patient.
Absolutely.
I mean, you want acknowledgement of whatever ails you, mm-hmm. but you don't want to be defined on the basis of what ails you.
Absolutely. Is there a piece in there of control of one's destiny feels to me like that would be something around dignity for me.
Yes. I always defer to the research that we did on this and issues that are related to, for example, continuity of self, role preservation. Those things are predictive for individuals, depending on, you know, their kind of existential wiring, in terms of maintaining their sense of dignity. But what's interesting is that even though illness oftentimes takes away the ability to do, patients, especially those who are able to, you know, adapt emotionally in a way that they can continue to value being. And that's critically important. I mean, I'm thinking about a woman that I looked after years ago, and I remember that, you know, even as she lay dying, she had always been the matriarch in her family. And I think her children were a little bit frightened of her. I mean, they loved her intensely, but they were a little bit frightened. And what was fascinating is that even though she could do less and less, as she lay in her bed, a single wag of her finger had everybody scurrying. Right. So, you know, I mean, so she had relinquished, I mean, her functional capacity, autonomy was undermined, but her ability to still maintain that sense of self or personhood. And yeah. And I've written about this. I mean, what are the things in the course of approaching, whether it's death or approaching a life-threatening or life-limiting condition, what are the things that illness can't touch?
You know, as I'm thinking about this more, in hearing you speak, it really strikes me that thinking back to taking care of various patients, what I think they perceived as their sense of self that would be important for their sense of dignity was completely different for different people. As in, for some people, the fact that their hair fell out and they, you know, weren't wearing makeup was unbearable. And for other people, they didn't care about that, but they cared more about if they could feed themselves, for example, or if the people that they loved were around them, or if the medical team listened to them and didn't infantilize them and ignore them.
Actually, we found that, we did a study in which we used an instrument that we had developed, the Patient Dignity Inventory, which is now translated into multiple languages and used in various places around the world. And one of the questions on that is no longer feeling like I'm the person I once was. Mm-hmm. And next to not being able to do the things that I normally do and concerns about discomfort, that was the thing that was most prevalent in a cohort of people who were nearing end of life. And so, you know, and again, when I'm kind of lecturing or, you know, meeting with trainees, I kind of remind them that, you know, I mean, how often is it that you make inquiries about personhood? And when I point out that, you know, well, no longer feeling like the person that they once were, turns out to be a profound and prominent existential issues for patients who are facing end-of-life circumstances.
I can definitely see that. And the other thing, as I'm thinking about patients I've seen when I hear you say that, is even that is so different for different people.
Absolutely.
For some people, it's more external things. And for other people, they don't care about the external things. There's something more internal that doesn't feel the same. Who do we feel is our sense of self as we come to the end, and how different that is for different people?
Absolutely. And the other thing that's kind of implicated in all of this is, again, getting back to this idea of the reflection in the caregiver's eye. Mm-hmm. What the data says then is that the perception of the provider, you know, the way that the provider experiences the patient, has a profound influence on what that person is going through. So we have spent a lot of time thinking about and trying to understand, how can we change the healthcare provider gaze, or make the healthcare provider feel mindful that their gaze, what happens between our ears, not just what we say to the patient or do to the patient, but how we are thinking and experiencing the patient, has a profound influence on whether or not that individual feels they are receiving kind of affirmation or not.
That's energetic, I think. I think that we bring a healing energy or not to the encounter with the patient, and it has a lot to do with what we think, but also how balanced we are ourselves and how we're able to be present with them.
Well, and it's a two-sided coin because, I mean, it's empowering. It means that, you know, we have this ability, we have this tool, which is about self, that we can bring into the therapeutic encounter. But along with that empowerment is responsibility. Mm-hmm. We then are in a position of either using that, yep, or not using it. And there isn't a neutral position. I mean, we may say, look, I really don't care about that stuff. All I want to know is, you know, how do I manipulate the drugs? How do I, you know, how do I learn to do the medical, you know, technical stuff? Say, well, even though you feel that that's a neutral position, it is saying, you know, to the patient, who you are matters less to me than what you are experiencing in terms of your medical ailment.
So when we say we treat someone with dignity, is that concept relevant here? Is the primary thing the gaze that we have of the patient and that we're reflecting back them as a person? Or is there a thing or things that we should be doing differently if we're going to treat people with dignity versus not so much?
Understanding, you know, what matters to that person, you know, and what that person values. I mean, we've done a series of studies and that have now been replicated in very large cohorts, much larger than I ever embarked on, which looked at something that we call the patient dignity question, trying to elicit in a very relatively easy and efficient way, finding out who is this person? You know, what do, and the patient dignity question essentially asks, what do I need to know about you as a person to take the best care of you possible? And the things that those brief conversations elicit are profound. There can be even, you know, more banal disclosures, like, you know, I appreciate when somebody speaks on my right side rather than my left because of my hearing, or I really find the television being on grating, so make sure that, you know, you don't have it on when I can no longer necessarily control my environment. But profound disclosures, like, you know, I'm the survivor of trauma, or one gentleman said, you know, I wish I could put a sign on my bedpost saying PIP, P-I-P. I said, and what does that mean? He said, previously important person.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And they're extraordinary disclosures. And what we have found when we've studied, I mean, we summarize these, we place them in the patient's chart with their permission. This is how people want to be seen. It's saying we want to have some control of the lens. If your gaze matters, yeah, then I ought to be able to have some control of the lens that you're seeing me through. Question, how do you provide, you know, dignity conserving care? It's being attentive to personhood, and, you know, and maybe in some ways not deviating so far from when we were first writing up the study, saying, well, what does the dictionary define dignity as? And it's, you know, being deserving of honor, respect, or esteem.
You know, during the earliest parts of COVID, when there were no vaccines and a lot of people died, I was working in the hospital as a palliative care doctor, and our palliative care social worker came back from a conference and said, we have to do this thing, which is we had papers that we would ask the family for the patients in the ICU, tell us about them. What did they like? Who were they? What were the most important things to them? And what do you want us to know about them? And we wrote it down and put it on the wall in all the ICU rooms for our patients. And it made a tremendous difference. I hate to say it. The patients were unconscious, so they had no idea. But in how the healthcare providers treated the patient, it was visibly different. It was mind-blowing and horrible, but also understandable. You know, they would say, oh, he has a master's degree. So somehow all of a sudden they saw him differently. And it was really a powerful experience. It made me think, if I'm ever in the hospital, I want one of those things on the wall, just like, see me for who I am, whatever that means to me at the time.
Well, you know, that's extraordinary, because during COVID, we did that study. You know, we had the intensivist approach family members whose loved ones were now unconscious on ventilators. And we called them in their home because with COVID and public health restrictions, we called them in their home. And I did some of these calls on my own. Families were gobsmacked.
Yeah, thrilled. Crying. Thank you so much for asking. Yes, really, it was unbelievable.
And so we would have a conversation 5 to 15 minutes, and it was focused on personhood. You know, what would you, how would they want to be seen? What would be important for them to have known, whether it's values or biographical or concerns, worries? We would summarize that into a few paragraphs, call them back at home, read it to them, allow them to make any editorial changes, and get their consent to place it on the chart. We enrolled 35 families during COVID. We're going to be submitting that for publication next week.
Wow.
And the results are off the charts. I mean, every family says this, not only was it emotionally a satisfying and important experience, but they would recommend it for any other patient or family in these circumstances.
Yeah.
And the disclosures, I mean, as you say, it changes your gaze. I mean, one example, I think this is going to be an exemplar in one of the papers, was a young woman, Terry, whose mother was now on a ventilator. And she basically says that she was a First Nations woman, who said that, you know, what her sister, this woman's daughter, had gone missing, likely murdered. And this mother had spent so much time not only trying to find her daughter, but had kind of emerged in the community as kind of a spiritual guide for many people. And the daughter went on to say that, you know, this entire time my mother has been in hospital, I've been trying to find a way of letting the staff know she's no ordinary person.
Wow.
And now this PDQ has allowed me to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's so fascinating to me that you did research in this, because I was so struck by, this was probably the most impactful intervention, and it cost a piece of paper. It's nothing. And it took us 15 minutes on the phone, and it was powerful for everyone. It was powerful for the family, as you know, but it was powerful for the healthcare team also, who want to see the people as people. They do. We do. And I have to feel like it was powerful for the patient, even though they were unconscious, because they did get interacted with differently. And also, often the people that I talked to wanted to share music, like the music that the person loved. And then sometimes the staff would put on the music in the room, which they would not have done had that thing not been on the wall. So it was really an interesting intervention. I'm so glad someone's researching it. It should be in every ICU, everywhere, all the time.
Well, and the way to try and make that happen is to hopefully be able to kind of take the data as we have and write it up as we have. And hopefully, I mean, we're going to be submitting it to a critical care journal.
Oh, fabulous.
So stay posted.
Yeah, good luck. I can't wait to read that.
When we developed this model of dignity in the terminally ill, it's sort of like a dignity map. A map helps you to find a place that is hard to reach, or may point out new places that you were unaware of. So one of the things that emerged on the model of dignity in the terminally ill was a notion that we labeled generativity. It's a term borrowed from the developmental psychologist Eric Erickson. You know, generativity versus stagnation. It's a psychosocial developmental phase that we all go through as we age. So what we discovered is that, for some patients, the assault on dignity is feeling that my life will not have mattered. You know, I won't have made a difference, or there won't be a ripple effect. You know, will I die twice? My death, and then, you know, fade in the memories of the people that will be left behind to mourn me. So we created an intervention called dignity therapy, which now is probably the most studied psychotherapy or brief psychological intervention in palliative care. There are nearly 100 publications, and at last count, it was somewhere between 10 to 12 systematic reviews of dignity therapy. It's a guided interview. In fact, I just enrolled a woman just this week. I'm going to be doing it next week. A woman, 35 years old, metastatic cervical cancer, 2 children. And I will be, I have sent her the framework of questions, which really are about what are the things, I mean, if you have an opportunity to have things documented about yourself, about your life, what is it that you would want known? What would you want said? In her case, she said, my kids aren't going to know me, particularly the younger one may have I want to embed some memories, the essence of who I am. So I will guide her through that conversation. It will be recorded. It will be transcribed. There is an editing protocol so that we can turn this dialogue into more of a kind of a pristine narrative. So it will read the way she would have written it in her voice and her work. And then we will review it with her, make sure, you know, just like with the patient dignity question, you know, is there anything that, you know, have we missed anything? Is there anything to be changed? And then we will give her copies for her to give to, you know, the people in her life who matter. In her instance, you know, for her husband, she also had some siblings. And eventually, you know, for these young children to be able to have that.
Wow.
Dignity therapy now is about, I mean, it's been around for about 20 years. I've written a book on dignity therapy, and there are programs, you know, various places on the globe. What's interesting is that it's not only being used in palliative care, but because dignity therapy is a way of kind of elevating awareness of personhood, mm-hmm. think about, well, what other situation is personhood under assault? Cognitive decline.
Exactly. So there have been thinking.
Yep. So there have been some studies of dignity therapy where the patient and the family member engage in this kind of as a co-construction. Mental illness. You know, the person. You know, self is the organ under assault. So there have been studies of dignity therapy in people with severe mental illness, and even in cohorts of individuals who are incarcerated. Which, again, you think about, you know, loss of autonomy, personhood.
That's powerful.
It is. Years ago, I got a chaplain, just out of nowhere, a hospital chaplain sent me a picture that was drawn by an inmate. And it's a pencil drawing of a man surrounded by bars. And this was the cover that he drew for his dignity therapy as he was dying and would die in this prison setting.
Wow. And so are there standardized questions that people use?
All of this is available online and at no charge. I have a website, dignityandcare.ca, dignityandcare.ca. And my book, Dignity Therapy, Final Words for Final Days, also contains this information. But what's even more important than the book is that people are receive some kind of training or instruction. Mm-hmm. And the questions that we're talking about are a framework. So it is not meant to be kind of pedantic and restricted. It's meant to be a conversation guided by, you know, what are things that this person wants or needs said. Mm-hmm. But the reason I underscore the importance of training is that people's lives are complicated. And sometimes stories are complicated. We also, I believe, have a duty to care, not only to the person who is giving this information, but bearing in mind that words are powerful and these words are going to be received by people that aren't necessarily, I mean, you can't change the word once it's there. And so as a therapist, you need to be mindful of what effect might this have on people who will be receiving this document. And that takes a certain amount of, well, training and being thoughtful and mindful of the power of the human word.
So is this something that you think should be restricted to a therapist, a licensed therapist, to do with a patient or family? Or do you see it also as a hospice chaplain?
Yes. I have trained certainly more social workers and chaplains over the years than I have physicians, and very few psychiatrists, quite a number of psychologists. I thought the direction you were going to go was asking about volunteers.
I would say no to volunteers. That feels scary, no?
I mean, that's exactly the position that I took in my book, which I wrote many years ago. Over the years, I think I've somewhat soften that position to say not all volunteers are created equal. And there are some programs. There's a program out of New Zealand that has been going for many years, and it is focused exclusively on volunteers, but it's an extremely well-organized program with lots of training and supervision. The bottom line is this kind of message of caution and humility. It's not as simple as read these questions, turn on a recorder, and you too can do dignity therapy. It's more complex than that.
So what about people who have had difficult lives? and trauma. I'm just thinking if someone says, okay, we're going to kind of wrap up your whole personhood here, you could tell the story in a couple different ways. I'm wondering, do people choose themselves? Do you guide them towards one or the other? Because you wouldn't want to whitewash it with the toxic positivity vibe, but also you don't want to have them relive all the traumas necessarily and have that be the final word. How do you negotiate that?
Carefully, thoughtfully, lots of humility, discussion as well with the patient before the session. I mean, when I spoke to that woman I was just telling you about that I'll be talking to next week, we had about a 10 or 15 minute conversation, what I call a framing interview. And that's really a chance to be able to tease out some of these issues. So, you know, where, you know, I mean, are there landmines buried? I ought to know about them. Who are the key players, by the way? What are your goals? I mean, why are you doing this? What is your intention? I mean, in her case, it was very straightforward. Yeah. You know, my children aren't going to know me. I want them to have something that will help them know me. Somebody whose life is more complex, maybe there has been trauma. You want to find out, what is it that you're hoping to accomplish? I remind trainees when they're looking at taking on dignity therapy, that it's not about painting a smile on everyone's life, because that has not been everyone's lived experience. Right. So what I am always looking for and always encouraging the patients to look for in doing this is, what needs to be said? Now, if you've experienced trauma, is there a need to recount that trauma so the world knows what you went through? Is there a lesson that you've taken out of that trauma? A gentleman that, and I think this is an example from the book, he had squandered most of his relationships. He was estranged from his family, multiple substance abuse, couldn't hold down a job. And I asked him, what is it that you hope your family takes away from hearing that story? I mean, what is the intent of leaving that as part of your legacy? He said, the intent is that they know their grandfather. It's too late to ask for forgiveness. I want them, though, to be able to follow a better example, to follow a different path.
That's powerful.
Absolutely. And it's not trying to put a smile on his life or say, you know, like, okay, now there's got to be a happy Christmas you want to tell us about. Right. And it, you know, because he wasn't interested. I mean, he couldn't remember a happy Christmas and wasn't interested in that disclosure. He had a specific reason for doing this. He realized that he had messed up in many ways and that forgiveness was not even on the table. But at least he could acknowledge it and say, follow a different path.
And so does that piece that you pulled out of him, that ends up in the document, I'm assuming.
Yes, that ends up in the document. That ends up in the document. Whereas, there are other instances where somebody may say something because people quickly forget, you know, that this is just a conversation. You seem like an easy person to talk to. So, right, of course, I'll tell you about this, that, or the other. Not realizing that what you're saying to me is going to be embedded in a document that will even transcend your death. So the instance, and again, I can't remember if this was in the book or not, but I remember a gentleman who had two sons. He was estranged from one, closer to the other. And when it came to talking about the estranged son, he was very critical of him, you know, because this kid hadn't been able to hold down a job and was unemployed. And he basically felt that his son had come back home when his father was now dying, and his son came back to actually help look after him. But he thought, you know, he was being like a freeloader. You know, these are the kinds of, it was very harsh.
Yeah.
And the responsibility of the therapist, you know, who is mindful of this, is to say, okay, I want to stop for a moment and remind you that what you're saying is being recorded, yeah, and is going to be part of the final thing that your son will take away from your life.
Yeah.
So is that what you would want to tell him, you know, that he is he's an irresponsible
loser.
And so he became very tearful and he looked at me, he says, no, you're right. I wouldn't want him to know that. What I would want him to know is that I love him and that he should get a job.
That is beautiful. Wow. I absolutely see why you want to come to this with some therapeutic skill, whether it's lay skill or licensed skill, because what a powerful intervention as this person is coming towards the end of their life that they wouldn't have otherwise, right? He may have gone to his death just thinking terrible things about this kid and not actually ever saying out loud that he loves him and cares about him.
And we've had family members who have responded, you know, after the fact and told me, you know, the only time I ever heard my father say he loved me was in that document.
Wow. So I'm just curious, if he had said, yeah, that's what I want to say, he's a loser, would you put that in the document?
Well, I mean, yeah, I've had these kind of conversations with a lot of people over the years who sort of push and say, okay, Chachanov, what if, you know, what if?
Does it not happen?
No, actually. I mean, it doesn't happen very much. I mean, although, listen, people are complicated and they're all kinds of people who might say, actually, I do want you to plant this bomb that'll blow up after my death. It's my document. I should be able to say whatever I want. And I said, well, you know, my advice to you is that if you have something to say to your family, you do it in the here now, because at least there's an opportunity for them to respond.
Yeah.
If you're asking me to be kind of your co-conspirator in planting a bomb, I'm not interested. Here's the document. You are free to do what you would like to do. I mean, if you want to use this as a way of being critical and vindictive and, you know, kind of this, leave this kind of toxic document behind, that's your decision, but I don't have to be a part of it. No more so than, Delia, I mean, if you went into the room of a patient and the patient sort of pulled you over and said, listen, you know, when I'm no longer here, I want you to tell him, you know, why our children don't look more like the neighbor than him. He'd say, excuse me, you know what? Like, they don't pay me enough for that. You know, if you have something to say to him, you know, that's your responsibility. But, you know, that's above my pay grade.
No, I actually really appreciate that answer. It might seem like I'm just being inflammatory, but I think the reason it's really important to talk about that is that the unit of care, as you well know, in palliative care is the patient plus the family. And Absolutely. That's why I was curious, because we try very hard not to get in a position of pitting one against the other, that we're caring for the whole unit in giving everybody what they need. And so I think your answer does exactly that. And I agree with that. That's how I would handle it too. So what have we missed as we start to think about closing? What have we missed in the topic of end of life coping and dignity therapy, et cetera?
I have introduced something that I call the platinum rule, which is a way of trying to have healthcare providers kind of confront their own biases and trying to extend care that the patient themselves would want, rather than kind of imposing an external standard based on what we ourselves might think would be best. Yeah. There's a publication that came out in the Journal of Clinical Oncology called Intensive Caring. And this really was inspired by the words of Dame Cicely Saunders, who said, you matter because you are you, but didn't necessarily provide us guidance on how do we help people who are suffering or feeling hopeless to feel that, in fact, they do matter. So it provides a framework of being able to be in the presence of suffering that hopefully can make us feel a little more empowered, a little less nihilistic, and less helpless in the face of suffering.
A lot of the people who are listening are healthcare providers, physicians, NPs, nurses, chaplains, social workers, and others. So if they're not yet reading your book and they're not yet trained in dignity therapy, but they feel this in their soul and they want to do a little better than they did yesterday, what is a thing or two that you might recommend that we all do differently than we might be doing it already?
I mean, a couple of things come to mind. One is for them to be mindful of just how profound an influence their own being, their way of seeing the world, their way of being with patients, how powerful that can be in terms of patient experience.
Yeah.
I don't think many people are necessarily always mindful of that. They don't have a sense that the way they carry themselves and are in the, and walk through this world necessarily has much of an influence on the people they care for. So that would be one thing I think that they can start to do now, is to have that awareness. And the second thing that is, I think, easy to add to their practice is, you know, thinking about that patient dignity question. what do I need to know about you as a person so I can take the best care of you possible? I remember years ago presenting at San Diego Hospice. At the time, Frank Ferris and Charles Van Gutten, the former editor of the Journal of Palliative Medicine, were the directors of that place. And I gave a talk and I discussed this. And at the end of it, I think it was either Frank or Charles who stood up and said, from now on, this is going to become part of the protocol of, you know, for all patients who come into this facility. It's easy to implement, and reminding ourselves that what your patient has is important. Who your patient is every bit as important.
Yeah. I love that question so much. And not just for end of life. Imagine if you just went to the gastroenterologist and they asked you that, you would feel so seen as opposed to feeling like a number. Right. And it also strikes me that just asking it changes not only the patient, but also the clinician, because you can't ask that question and then be completely disconnected from the patient. It tethers you to the person in a heart-centered, energetic way that is better for you and is better for the patient, both.
Well, we have data that shows that in 90% of instances, in response to the PDQ, healthcare providers learn something that they didn't previously know. And anywhere from 40 to 65% of instances, it enhances things like respect, empathy, connectedness. The things that people tell you about personhood are profound and they can't be unseen. And as you pointed out, it changes not necessarily even the actual mechanics of care, but it changes what we refer to as the tone of care.
So if people want to learn more about you, get your books, talk to you about things, collaborate with you on research, where do they find you?
I'm on social media. I'm on Twitter, at HM Chachanov. I'm on LinkedIn. And my email, harvey.chachanov@cancercare.mb.ca.
Thank you so much for being here with us today.
My pleasure.
All right, everybody. I think all of you should start using the patient dignity question on nearly every patient encounter. Try it out. Try it for a week with most of your patients and see what happens. See if you learn things that you hadn't learned before. See if you feel differently about the encounter. And share this with somebody else who you think would enjoy this kind of heart-centered approach to care. Thanks so much for being here. I'll see you next Thursday. Bye-bye. This podcast is brought to you by the Integrative Palliative Institute. Visit our website, integrativepalliative.com. There you can access physician and clinician training, well-being coaching, free downloads, and other cool stuff. And feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn and share your favorite episode with a friend.